Welcome to the Popcorn Talk Network, for the online broadcast network that features movie discussion, news, and interviews. Press one.
Popcorn Talk. We talk movies.
I'm opening. We have an eye, sort of a nostril, two teeth. One of the teeth has a small cavity. Close call, folks, but I think we got here just in time.
Presented by Maria Menounos and Kevin Undergaro. This is Anatomy of a Movie. In-depth discussions and breakdowns of various movie titles. And now that you've seen the movie, let the dissection begin.
There it is. There it is. You gotta love the music. You gotta love it. So welcome, everybody. Thank you for joining us for another Anatomy of a Movie. This week on the slab, as you can tell from the music, Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation. I'm John Comerford, joined in the studio by Phil Svitek.
One of the most iconic themes ever.
That's right.
Absolutely.
We and that's Dimitri Panos.
Hello, movie fans. Yes. Love this theme.
And yes, and you cited who wrote it, because a lot of people don't know.
Layla Schifrin.
Yes, but way back in the late 60s or the 70s, whatever it was, and still getting paid royalties.
Absolutely.
Congratulations to them.
Absolutely.
So, what do we think? Let's get into our overall impressions. Phil.
This was the first, I will admit, whether you choose to accept this or not is up to you. This is the first Mission Impossible experience ever.
Where the hell
TV
have you
show
been?
Or movie? No, it's just one of those things that, they kept making movie after movie, and yeah. I just, you know, initially.
Figured eventually you'll get to it?
Well, no, back in the late 90s when this first came out, I didn't see a lot of movies, and so I was selective with the movie. You know, that was the time I'd see two movies a year. So with the movies that you chose, we had to be very specific. And so this was one of those movies that just wasn't on the list, and then eventually more and more movies came out, and I just never got around to seeing them. That being said.
Okay, you can't rate them in order, but as.
I can't.
A standalone movie, what do you think?
As a standalone movie, I it made sense to me. I feel like, you know, I'm sure there's Easter eggs and all this other stuff that you guys will talk about, but I enjoyed it. And I thought it was a really fantastic movie and a great blockbuster summer film. And I thought Tom and the rest of the cast did amazing. Good.
Yeah.
Really good.
Mm-hmm. Dimitri.
Yeah, I think, I personally think it's the best action movie we've had this summer since Mad Max Fury Road. And I'll take it a little bit farther. You know, Mad Max Fury Road's great action picture, you know, not denying that. But this one, for me, had excellent action, great direction, great plotting. It's all around, it's a fun movie. You don't necessarily have to check your brain in at the box office either, because there's lots going on. There's lots to try to keep track of. I love the start big, end small mentality, sort of kind of World War Z-ish. I'll tell you, if our couch were on camera, I'd be jumping up and down the couch saying how much I love this movie. I had a great time.
All right. It was a great popcorn movie, lots of fun. I don't know anybody that has seen it hasn't liked it. On some level, so I mean,
it's the most successful
movie,
one.
Mm-hmm. The best opening of any MI, and congratulations to them. And especially because you're coming in the fifth installment, and you're still making it interesting enough for audiences to go to on the opening weekend. Because don't you think that you would have felt, oh, okay, we've seen it, we've done it a million times, we're not going to do it again. And
absolutely,
they overcame that.
No, I mean they have, and you're right. The fifth movie, already. You would figure. Yeah, there could be some franchise fatigue. But Tom Cruise and company, with Skydance and such, and Paramount. And Bad Robot. And again, I gotta give some credit to J.J. Abrams and Bad Robot, because when he was handed the reins for Mission Impossible 3, that in a sense was almost, I don't want to say rebooting, but he reinvigorated this franchise. And, and ever since he's always kept his hand in the cookie jar, so to speak. And I think that's been fantastic, because the movies have really proven to be very collaborative with writer and director. And we've got great, throughout the entire franchise, we've gotten some great directors. Everybody from Brian De Palma, John Woo, J.J. Abrams, Brad Bird, which interestingly enough, it was there to foray into feature film live action. Like, it was Brad Bird's first live action movie. You know, and then now you come Christopher McQuarrie, who he and Tom Cruise had worked together many times before. Academy Award winner for The Usual Suspects screenplay. They keep it fresh, and they go in knowing, like, we have to really, not so much, let's not try to outdo, but we want to make something new and make it standalone. And like yourself, you didn't feel lost. You didn't feel like you had to pick up any of the pieces. Like, each movie stands alone in a way that anybody who may have not seen the previous ones can come in and really enjoy this movie as a summer or blockbuster type of film.
That's one of the questions I have for somebody who hadn't seen the others, because you got Luther, the character of Luther. You know right away, you don't need much expos who Luther is, you know, because you pretty much get him, even though you haven't seen the others, right? You know, okay, it's just one of Ethan Hunt's best buds, and he works with all the time. You didn't need much.
No,
explain that.
You knew most of it, and I don't know. This is even though I haven't seen the other movies, obviously there's staples of it that I don't know if you can run away from. Right, the choose to accept the mission or not type of thing.
Although they even twisted that,
which
was nice.
You know, and the whole the mask coming off. I knew that was a staple of these movies. So there's various things that I knew.
And the television show.
Absolutely. They've kept that since then. So. But even that was done with, because, you know, at that point of the movie, for me, I kind of forgot that they were doing that. And as soon as, right, just like 2 seconds before, here we get the thing, finally.
Yeah.
We get that face pull.
And you know what's been great about the face pull is that, at least as of now, as of coming into Rogue Nation, and they use that device again, you know, Mission Impossible 2, I thought, overused that device. Mm-hmm. To an extent. And yeah, it was like there was so much face pulling.
Yeah.
We're like, okay.
Were they Martians? Everybody's peeling their face off.
Everybody's peeling a face off. And you figure, okay, after two, it's done. But then J.J. Abrams comes in and says, you know what, though? We need, like, forget about two. This is a staple in the show, and we're going to use it, but it's going to be a major, you know, we're going to use it to get the villain, and it'll perpetuate plot. And since then, too, you know.
But the fact that they only used it once, it was very sparingly, and way late in the movie, because so you could have all the other tricks, because they have all the other gadgets that they have and everything, which are terrific. And then by that time of the movie, you'd forgotten about it.
And it was referenced, too, because Simon Pegg's Benji says, oh, I get to wear a mask. I finally, you know, and, you know, it doesn't happen to him.
Yeah.
But it's like you said, it's so clever, because by the time that twist comes at the end, the mask, of course. That's great.
So, and you were aware of that even though you hadn't seen the movies, Phil?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that you just, for some reason,
I don't know how it seeps into the knowledge. I don't know if I sought it out in some sort of way, or it's just that unavoidable. I don't know 100%, but like I said, it's Mission Impossible. Whether you've seen them or not, the music hits, you know what you're in. And you get what it's on, you understand what it's about.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's talk about the story, per se. Obviously, Christopher McQuarrie is credited with writing it, and they had other writers on to begin with. Pierce was one of them, and who else did we have? We had two other writers. But he had the final credit. Go ahead.
No, I beg your pardon.
I thought you were going to say. But I just wanted to talk story first of all, because obviously they did a different take on this. Almost all these movies start off with some sort of gag because they want to hook the audience, and this one was no exception. We get the full on airplane that everybody is aware of because they've seen it all over the posters and the commercials, etc. Did it disappoint to open up the movie that way?
Right,
not at all.
Drew Pierce was
one of the other writers.
I thought, you know, I didn't realize this was going to be the first scene.
Right,
that's what I didn't realize. And to have that be the first scene, I thought that was just, I thought it was fantastic, and it set us off in the best of ways. It had elements of comedy, obviously action. Mm-hmm. And, you know, danger of, like, open the door. Oh, I got the back. But to be able to use then that element of, you know, the cargo door opening versus the actual door and how it plays into ultimately, you know, he's able to use those elements. Yeah. It set us off in the right mood. And then, you know, you get the actual credits, you get the music, Mission Impossible, boom, you're in.
Yeah, I thought it was actually genius, too, because so much was spent on the marketing, which... I thought the marketing was very fascinating to me because you were actually, you know, it was all about Tom Cruise. It was all about practicality of stunts, and our actor, our main actor, Tom Cruise, is doing the stunts. And it's really interesting to me because to me that's sort of an evolution. And on the Blu-ray or DVD of Mission Impossible 3, right, there's a special feature. It's a documentary about Tom Cruise doing all of the stunts and J.J. Abrams going, yeah, the man would do anything, pretty much anything we asked him, pretty much. You know, and you'd see him either hanging from a car, being a pendulum kind of thing or stuff. So, and I remember seeing that going, well, geez, that's pretty cool. It's pretty dangerous. I didn't realize. And then there was some talk about it because he was hanging off the building in Dubai. And this one, it just, they really hinged on that. And I think that the genesis of the marketing campaign, I'll have to say, probably it started at CinemaCon, because this I was at CinemaCon in March, which is a huge convention for exhibitors and distributors, and the distributors get to show off their upcoming products for the summer. And Paramount trotted
out the sequence.
Yeah, they trot out Tom Cruise, Simon Pegg, and Rebecca Ferguson, but Tom Cruise comes out first. And man, like when you talk about star power, like he is a star. The charisma that he oozes when and he captivated the Caesar's Palace, the Celine Dion room, okay, the Colosseum, and everybody. And then he flashes that smile, and then hey, thank you all for coming. Hey, I'm out here. I want to show you. I'm going to show you something that you haven't seen before. I'm going to show you this behind the scenes thing. And he talked about the plane sequence. So he goes, all right, so you saw the timing code bar. And then Tom Cruise did a live, like, Blu-ray, DVD, Laserdisc-type commentary telling you how the shot was set up, how it was really cold, and he needed special contact lenses, and you know, how fast he was going to be going, and that he's hanging on by this thing on the other side of the door. And then the plane starts going down the runway, and he's like, yeah, right now, he goes, I am scared shitless. He goes, I'm going down, and all of a sudden, my feet just get taken away from me. They slide off the wing, and I'm hanging on. He goes, and I'm fearing for my life, and at the same time, I'm trying to think, all right, the director and the editor, they're going to need a shot of me doing this. He's thinking about how they're going to edit the movie while he's being carted up, and I'm like going, that's amazing to me. He goes, and then we had to come around, land, and do it again. And it was really cold. And I'm like going, that's amazing. And it really got the crowd going. And then he trots out Simon Pegg, who talked about the car chase scene. They were really driving, and Simon Pegg was like, oh, there's no acting from me involved. He goes, he was driving and hitting his marks. He was literally slamming into the cars. And then Rebecca Ferguson comes out and talks about the fight scene that she's in. So a lot of this marketing talked about the practicality of effects, which is sort of kind of refreshing when you think about it, because all of our movies, a lot of them this summer, they've been trying to say, hey, there's still practical effects in Jurassic Park, but we had to rely on CG.
That's one of these, like Fury Road, so much everybody's talked about practical.
Yeah, so, you know, I think it's great that they did this, and I love the fact that the movie opened up on the plane sequence, because we had heard so much about it that, okay, here it is, it's the beginning of the movie, now you get to enjoy the rest of the movie. And with all its plot twists and everything, you know, we get that out of the way. I thought that was brilliant. And, you know, I wasn't tired of seeing the plane sequence at the beginning either. I was like, oh, here's that sequence. And, you know, it plays out a little bit more.
It's terrific. The only thing I missed, I really wanted to see him fly out of that. I wanted to see the parachutes take him out. But we cut too soon. We didn't get to see that shot. Because I'm going, man, they probably didn't get that shot. Didn't you want to see them? I wanted to see him go. I wanted to see the parachutes. Yeah. I wanted to see, oh, damn.
Yeah,
that would have been a much harder shot to get.
I don't think any insurance company would have
probably
that.
Not have that. Yeah, probably not been able to do that one. That would have been a nice one, right?
Yeah,
because I'm thinking, oh, he's doing that. Why not? Let's see the next one. Yeah. But he didn't get that.
And again, I have to, you know, I think that J.J. Abrams, starting with 3, that was really the first one that interjected a lot of humor.
Yeah, this one had a lot.
And this one
more
had
more so than the others.
Yeah, and I think in a movie like this...
Is it because it's just Simon Pegg in general?
Well, it helps, but even without... I mean, just Jeremy Renner and Ving Rhames talking in the, oh, you had to bring this car. You had to get this car to chase. I mean, yeah. Just those moments like that were fun.
And they even normally wouldn't... Baldwin
yeah.
stuff, too. Some yeah. dialogue, oh, welcome, you know, welcome to the CIA.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's
welcome
good.
Because they normally, well, in the other ones, they didn't have those.
Yeah, the first two, not exactly humorless,
no.
but they didn't.
No, they didn't constantly. Yeah. They didn't make it a point to go for the joke.
Right.
I don't recall that, anyway.
In terms of Alec Baldwin, I think he's more ball busting than anything, and I think that's why it's funny. Cause,
mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And he's just so incompetent in general.
Yeah.
No, that was his character. Yeah. You know, we're going to find this guy, and then immediately, 6 months later, it's going to be a matter of days, 6 months. Like, no, he didn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's how good he is. Yeah, and then Cuba, when he's in Paris, it's like, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
But that was to show how good Ethan was.
Yes. Yeah.
And Jeremy Renner, he was just, you know, his interactions with him in general was just the snarkiness. Again, you know, I can neither deny or confirm.
Yeah,
that was good.
We had good. But overall, did you love the plot about a syndicate? You know, the Spectre in the James Bond. You know, that's their version
of
Spectre.
And it's I did, because again, it was a little thread that comes from Ghost Protocol,
mm-hmm.
that the syndicate is sort of kind of, you know, mentioned, and I enjoyed it. And it was funny because you cannot help but think of Spectre mm-hmm. in James Bond, especially when that trailer plays before, at least in my screen, in huge XD, and the trailer looked great. But going into this, I really, not only did I like the way that it was plotted, but it had good plausible twists. Mm-hmm. And how did they, you know, how did this guy, Lane, mm-hmm. Stay ahead of Ethan Hunt and control everything
over a year?
For over a year, and you had a really solid villain. That
so I'm going to disagree with that point. That would be my
really
I'm not saying that he wasn't in terms of plot. You know, because he had this great plan and all this other stuff. I should qualify that by saying I just don't think they give him enough to do, and it was like. He shot again once. I didn't think he was as diabolical as I wanted him to be, or you know. And then the reason why he was doing it was kind of just thrown in. It was like that to me was kind of a misstep. It didn't really have a lot of gravitas.
I think in lieu of Age of Ultron, any reason was a good reason for the villain. No, because I mean, it was just so stupidly didactic for me. Whereas this, I didn't. You know, at least it made more sense. You know, I mean, they built a whole kind of coalition around that premise. You know, it wasn't just him. Yes, he was the ringleader, but there was other people involved, and it made it you know, it gave it a structure and a world.
Yeah, no, that part's great too. But I'm going, okay, so he got all these former agents to join him, and what was how did he do this? Is it just money that got them to do it? Are they following some sort of? You know, because his raison d'etre was because he wanted to get back. He wanted, you know, retribution. I mean, it was kind of like, what? So all these agents are just going to follow him?
He's a very disgruntled guy.
Yeah,
But where I give it credit is that, and where it's a bit different from Bond, is that there wasn't the whole world domination kind of a thing.
Yeah, I know that, you know which can get trite and silly.
And I don't know. I thought as a villain, they played more to his intellect and smarts and staying one step ahead and knowing that he could impose danger and very violently if need be. I was, I guess, a little bit like, wow, how much longer is he going to put up with Rebecca Ferguson's character? I was wondering, like, and I knew that there was going to be some setup, but I also felt, though, that the movie made it plausible for him not to kill her off because there was always some, well, I did, but your guys, messed this up.
And according to him, he knew it was always going to play out that way anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, for me,
it's
I go, well,
part of the plan.
Which I'm going, well, that's an easy out. You don't really have to explain anything because you can just say, yeah, I knew it was going to end up here. So you don't really have to have logic and reason in there. But to me, those are missteps.
It makes people like me look, how did he know that?
Yeah.
He was so much smarter than everybody.
Yeah.
He knows 18 months down the line it's going to end
like
up here.
He's like playing chess.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm going.
But I also felt him a formidable foe for Ethan because they made the IMF, they made them look like they were crazy.
You know,
Ethan was like, okay, we got to there's a rogue nation out there. And that was the whole thing about the CIA. It's like, yeah, Ethan, you've gone off the deep end.
And so, everywhere you've been, something bad has happened.
Right.
So, I mean, yeah, that part was plausible.
But they even set Ethan Hunt to maybe be a little unbalanced. Mm-hmm. Okay. To be a little like maybe all these years of work are finally getting to him. And like maybe he's imagining certain things. Mm-hmm. And even Ethan Hunt is like, he questions himself a little bit in this movie. And that's what I like, because there was that frailty and that fallibility that he could have. And seeing his secretary get shot. And, you know, a lot of people have died. They've come close to dying while Ethan Hunt has been on the job. And he's been double-crossed and everything. So you sort of kind of get that he might be a little off and he's starting to second-guess himself. And I think that that led to a very emotional, like a great, yeah, moment when the bad guy, well, sort of gets it, but doesn't get it, but gets captured. And I love that in the end.
I did too, but there were a couple of missteps for me in the setup, because I don't think they did a strong enough tie between Ethan and his secretary to make that look like it's a personal thing. Because it was, obviously, it was a secretary, but that was just kind of, they just threw that in there. I'm going to shoot your secretary.
I didn't know it was a secretary. What?
Yeah, secretary.
I didn't know it was a secretary.
So they didn't really do that. So, because had it been more of a personal connection that you could have experienced and seen, then you would have seen his impetus for really going after this guy, other than the obvious, which is he just killed somebody, an innocent person. Yeah. But if it was a personal thing that you got to know and experience, that would have been a much better hook to for a driving force for him, as opposed to, because it was like just thrown in. That, oh, your secretary. Wait, secretary. They didn't. That, wait.
No, and I was agree weird that. I'll give you that, you know, because I was like, oh, secretary. I just thought she was part of the IMF.
Right.
She was an agent.
Yeah,
but. And he doesn't want to see an agent down. But
exactly.
Realize,
but it would have been nice if they had given us the personal moment between the two. Then we would know how deeply that would affect him emotionally. But we didn't get that. And then I thought he's in the room and the agent, he doesn't have a gun. He doesn't carry a gun around to get out of that room. I mean. The smoke-filled room and stuff. I go, that's it? That the great Ethan Hunt gets screwed by a closet?
Yeah. Hey,
I was like, okay.
How did the villain get screwed
by? No, I agree. So, but that was, you know.
But, yeah,
all right.
Justice. You know, but the other thing, too, with Ethan Hunt, if you're going back, especially to 3, you had the Kerry Russell character who like, at least there was dialogue, because he sort of kind of trained that character, and she dies within the first 10 minutes of the movie. Yeah. Sorry, Phil.
Right.
But it is something.
Carry that,
10 minutes.
That's great. Yeah, but exactly. That's my point.
But it is something
you completely know.
Plot.
Yeah, that's mentor protege kind of thing. Or,
but we do know that Ethan Hunt has said, I've been tracking these people. Right. They exist.
Sure.
I've been tracking them down for a year.
Yeah.
And this is how, like, they've, you know, and again, before the show started, it was a very nice twist to the Ethan, should you decide to accept this.
No, that was great. I love that. I love the
that
twist.
Was great,
yeah,
too.
Like,
I love that.
Wait
a
minute.
Wait.
Yeah, that was terrific.
It's like, they know we exist.
Yeah.
We know they exist.
Uh-huh.
And they're still making me look like I'm crazy.
And the other thing that I thought was strange, as Phil pointed out earlier, is that the CIA for 6 months can't find Ethan. I mean, obviously Ethan's an amazing agent,
right.
You know, clearly, but it's like, really? You can't, you've got nothing. And the other thing, the other point about that story is they have, that for some reason they make Alec Baldwin say, look, so we're gonna go after him. And basically they're gonna, I forgot what the term they use, but shoot to kill is basically the order. And I went, okay. But then they don't track it. Nobody's going after him. There's no agency or no agent that's actually going after him. So I was like, why did they even bother setting that up if you're not going to pay that off?
I think the payoff was that he's that good.
Well,
that's just what I, you know, and I went along with it. I thought it was fine. And yeah, I thought the way they played it off in terms of the lie detection tests and, you know.
That part was fun. Yeah, they had lots of fun. But what I don't like was Alec Baldwin saying, okay, because it said, oh my God, he's sending agents to kill him, and then no agent shows up to kill him.
Well, because they're somewhere. They're in a different country.
I agree, but I go, that's my point is, then don't set it up, because I'm sitting there waiting for the thing, and that never comes to fruition. I'm going,
well it comes to fruition when eventually, you know, they're back at the board meeting, and like, why did you do this?
You don't need that plot device to do that, because you set something up that you don't pay off.
It ultimately didn't bother me.
I wanted him in more jeopardy. I wanted him his
in
own
more jeopardy?
Yes, because I wanted
Holy
his own
cow.
People coming after him.
I think they were.
But they, but we didn't get to see any of that. They never showed
got
it.
To
they
see
never
see them in but, Cuba.
Yeah,
but here's the thing. I want
to, after they gives after he gives the license to kill, nothing. And it's like, don't bother, don't set it up, because I'm going, you already showed him to Cuba. They got to be pissed that they missed him. And I'm thinking, now he's got not only the bad guys to get, but he got his own people that are coming after him, and they nothing.
I again, I didn't necessarily mind, because what I loved about this movie was the internal struggle of him, of even if he got these people, right? So forget, you know, he's trying to prove to, you know, whether the CIA or his own people that this is real, or even to himself. Yeah. It's that, okay, does this even make sense? Because it's just going to, it's never an evolving cycle of this stuff. And I really like that. And so, you know, it gave weight to that, versus if now all of a sudden we got to deal with actual CIA agents going after him. I think it would just, it would have been great action, don't get me wrong, 100%. Yeah. But I love that this can be more than just an action movie.
Yeah.
Well, and I'm saying it would have been more, because then you'd have more factions, being more conflict, more drama, because you had great, you know, conflicting agencies, and who's, what side are you on, and all that. That was terrific. But then you could have the external forces of those conflicting agencies coming at you. To me, that would have been a much more exciting and interesting movie. Because even though I like this movie, it missed on that, because it also missed on the idea that They do this great thing. Well, they set up this thing about, okay, so he's got Rogue Nation, and he's creating this syndicate, and for what purpose? And then that, just to get back. And I'm going, but I don't think they really tied in. Well, what's the effect? How's it going to affect everybody? What was the jeopardy there? I mean, yeah, I know that they bombed this thing and they dropped that plane and all that other stuff.
Yeah, they were clearly acts of terrorism that were like, you know, smoke and mirrors to point to somebody else, but they were clearly behind it. They were the Spectre.
Yeah.
They, you know, in a sense, they were Spectre. And you know, it didn't bother me that we didn't have more of the CIA scenes and them coming after him, because they did mention in the movie, it's like, where Lane is one step ahead of me, you know, I am going to be like 10 steps ahead of the CIA. I know how they're going to operate. So that didn't like bother me, because again, it really did streamline our picture too. And it focused on Ethan Hunt's plight, and then getting the team back together. Now, I enjoyed this part as well, because it wasn't Ethan Hunt looking all over the world to get his team back together. We had to, you know, extract them from some. No, like Benji says. And that to me was a great scene where Benji's like, no, Ethan, you don't get to send me away. Like, I lied for you, and like my life is on the line. He goes, they're going to peg me as a traitor. And he goes, no, I choose to be here with you. You've been a great friend. And for me, that scene was like, again, we don't see that in action movies all that much. It's usually the person trying to get the team back.
Right.
This is the team wanting Ethan Hunt back.
There plenty of those things.
Yeah. And you know, Ving Rhames was great to see. You know, he and Tom Cruise are the only ones who've been in every single movie since the Brian De Palma Mission Impossible. And I don't know. I enjoy it. You know, it was, you know, Jeremy Renner came in
in
Ghost Protocol. You know, Michelle Monaghan, you know, we've had different women who were part of the team. And that I was like sort of weird. Like that almost seemed to be a revolving door for me. We had Paula Patton was in Ghost Protocol. Thandi Newton was in two.
Yeah, I'm
but
just
she,
saying,
she played more of the victim. She wasn't part of the actual.
Oh, you're talking about his team?
Yeah, part of his team. Mm-hmm. And God, I forget. In Mission Impossible 3, please forgive me.
Well, you said Carrie Russell.
She pretty much helped the plot of the movie, but he had she was in like the Nikita movie television series. I forget her name. Wonderful Asian actress. I forget her name. I'm sorry. No disrespect, but they were meant to be in this movie. Mm-hmm. Their characters were written in, but they were filming other projects. They just couldn't fit it into their schedules. Mm-hmm. I think finding Rebecca Ferguson was great. I mean, she was awesome. I think she did a fantastic job. You know, and another great fine showcase for strong women in film this summer. Yeah. You know,
Yeah, I thought you did a fabulous job, and I thought it was great that they didn't turn it into a love interest, because that's...
Me too.
It's just like, you know, that's another trope we've seen a million times, but it was great just to have her be the agent she is and have that little thing kind of there but not, which allows him to still be married.
Yeah.
And not have to deal with that issue. What did you think of her?
I thought she was fantastic right from that opening scene, you know, and I don't know what the... taking off the shoes.
Yeah, does anybody know what that means? It's like, what? Okay, all right.
I can only figure because she knew she was going to get into a fight,
which is weird.
Fight,
yeah. Because no, that part is good. But you know, she's pulling out of the vials and everything and the things, and you know, and she has to go in there because she's supposed to break him or at least get information from him. And the shoes come off, which doesn't really... It's like, why would she think she has to do a fight if she's got all these vials? So it was just weird.
But
then there's a callback at the Austrian Vienna. Opera.
That scene, and again, I'm not even 100% sure this is an Easter egg. I mean, it's too much of a coincidence almost, but she does sort of set up. She takes out a rabbit's foot.
Yeah.
If memory
serves. Well, she found that was on the table.
Right. Yeah. But the rabbit's foot, if memory serves too, she finds that the rabbit's foot it could be a recall to part three, which... Philip Seymour Hoffman's character, like he's having Tom Cruise run all around Shanghai to get the rabbit's foot.
Oh, right.
Like that, I believe, was the MacGuffin or MacGuffin in that movie. And when he sees all this stuff and she takes off her shoes, she knows that this guy is going to do a hell of a lot more than just try to break him down, that he could potentially die. You know, and it set up a great fight scene, and it set up a great line where Tom Cruise is like, Do we know each other? It's like he truly
There's
is
a meet cute
like,
for
confused.
You.
Yeah,
you know, it's a great scene.
Yeah, she was. I thought she was very strong throughout, and you know, I thought towards the end when she's trying to convince him, like, hey, let's just leave. I thought that was a great scene because again, it really shows his conflict and became more than just an action movie.
Yeah.
I don't know much about her in general. I was trying to research her. She's still very young.
Yeah.
And I really did actually respect the fact that she wasn't the love interest.
Yeah.
Because to tack that on at the end...
it would have been just crowbarred in.
Yeah, because it would have been like, okay, let's end this. Oh, let me embrace you and let's kiss.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have.
I agree. And some people have said that maybe it is a reference that Tom Cruise is still married.
Mm-hmm.
So even though Michelle Monaghan's character wasn't present at all.
Yeah.
So... And an interesting story about that, if I can bring that up, here talking about Rogue Nation. Apparently, in one of the original drafts of the script before Macquarie came on board, they had her character in it.
This
Michelle Monaghan's
character. Drew Pierce
character.
Or Will Staples, either one of them, not exactly sure.
And apparently she was killed off in the beginning of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And Macquarie saw this and like just redlined it and said, nope, not going to happen. He's like, and when asked why, I love his reasoning. He goes, Alien 3. That's why that didn't happen. He goes, I went in to see Alien 3 and within the first 5 minutes, they killed Newt.
Yeah,
he
Newt, by the way, is the character, the
Newt
little girl
is
in
little girl
Aliens, Alien 2.
That.
Sigourney
becomes a surrogate mother too. Yeah. And if you've watched Aliens, you spend a good 2.5 hours, you know, sweating it out for the survival
Poor
of
Newt
Hicks and Ripley. And then within the first 5 minutes of Alien 3,
they
killed her and Hicks off. And he's like, for me, he goes, I hated that so much. It was such a bad cheat. He goes, when I saw that on the script, I felt the same exact way, and I just cut it out. We're cutting it out. We're not going to reference her. And I was like, I get that. I totally understood that reasoning. Mm-hmm. And I too think that had they killed Michelle Monaghan off, you know,
it sets up a whole other thing for your main character to have to deal with, and it could have been fine, but I like that they didn't include it.
Yeah,
I mean, you could have a whole movie just on that.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
you know, cause
and there's
how he deals with that grief, and you know,
yeah.
So,
but I don't want to see that.
No. And again, though, having read that script,
yeah.
There may have been a love interest.
Yeah, it could have been.
Which, you know, between Isla and Ethan Hunt.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad that Macquarie had the sense enough to change that around.
All right, well, anything else on the story? Because I have my misgivings about it. I enjoyed the movie, but I just thought, you know, for me, it could have been much more interesting. in terms of its plot and characterization.
I thought it was well played, and to me, Simon Pegg just stood out as a secondary character because I thought he was really funny.
He was,
you know, especially towards the end. This isn't him talking. This is me now. So
you know, and what's great about Simon Pegg is his debut into the Mission series was Mission Impossible 3, and he's in that movie for a whole of 5 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
He literally is he's in the movie pretty much behind a desk,
yeah,
for the most part,
he's working
just
at a computer,
helping Ethan Hunt here and there. And with a 5 maybe 10 minutes, he's in the movie. He became a favorite, and he enjoyed working along with Tom Cruise. So when it came to Ghost Protocol, it's like, we got to bring Benji back. Mm-hmm. And Simon Pegg is perfect for this, and he's got to love it. I mean, God, he's in this.
I love
he's
that he was
Star Trek.
Doing his great video games and trying to be Ethan Hunt. And then he actually gets a chance to do that in real life. And it doesn't go so well.
Yeah, and I always love, too, like in the movies, like, you know, Ethan, but we can go in and out. Like, let's just do this. We'll be in and out in 5 minutes. Yeah. What's the problem, Ethan? You can't hold your breath for 2 minutes? Really?
Yeah.
What was your favorite sequence overall? Because what I did like, we got the big one at the top, and then we slowly kind of built towards the bigger ones down the line. You know, and I thought, speaking of, you know, the holding of your breath, I thought that was a great sequence in general.
Mm-hmm.
I've never
that
seen
too. Yeah.
You know,
you like the water sequence?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, I loved it, but for me it was the Vienna Opera House. That was my favorite sequence because it took so much to do, and I'm not saying that the water sequence didn't, because Tom Cruise is literally underwater. Like, again, that's another stunt that he is doing, and you know, I love that sequence too, but for me it was just the way that the Vienna Opera sequence was filmed, choreographed, edited, shot. I just loved all the pieces of this puzzle taking place and what it sets up and how it educates an audience to certain things. That to me was my standout sequence for me.
John?
And there's great stories behind that filming that sequence as well. So
I don't know. My favorite sequence. I think I liked the chase, the cars and the bikes, only motorcycles. Mostly because of the humor involved at the end, and the guy coming up to the upturned car, and he's got pulling the gun out,
boom,
and the SUV takes him out. It's like, yeah, I like those.
That was great.
The reason why I didn't fully like the Vienna scene is because it all felt all for naught.
Oh, because they didn't get the thing.
Well, no,
because he died.
Yeah, exactly. It was the failsafe.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, oh, we watched. Oh. Oops.
Yeah. Oh, we came so close. Yeah, but you know,
and obviously that's going to be the movie. But in general,
they have to fail.
But again, if you think about it, and Macquarie himself had said that was probably the most difficult sequence that they had
to shoot. Okay.
Yeah, and a couple of things they did actually film at the Vienna Opera House, but they only had a couple of days to do so.
Yeah.
So they had to go to a sound stage that's mostly reserved for. Like for band, for concerts, for rehearsal for concerts.
Mm-hmm.
So it was this huge soundstage, and they built the set from floor to ceiling. So the catwalk in which Tom Cruise is in is literally 60 feet up off the ground. They thought about lowering it, but they said, nope, this is only going to work. We're going to have it 60 feet up off the ground. And when you think of all the pieces to go together, like Ralph McQuarrie had said, he goes, Chris McQuarrie, I'm sorry, Ralph McQuarrie, the artist, my apologies. Chris McQuarrie said, he goes, this sequence is about educating an audience on the geography of the scene without you feeling like you're being
educated. Yeah, exactly. You can't teach them.
He goes, right. And he goes, but I want everybody to see. And he goes, there are very important things in here, like when Ethan Hunt comes across the guy, the blonde-headed guy.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, up to that point, Ethan Hunt does not know who Lane is or what he really looks like. So he's thinking that this guy is Lane because he's there to take out this prime minister guy. And the scene where there's a close-up on that henchman's eye, you know, that is when it goes out. Ethan Hunt realizes this isn't the guy that I'm hunting.
There's a guy behind the guy.
Yeah, this isn't the guy. Okay. This isn't the guy that killed my secretary. Like, this, like, shit, I'm in another fight. And meanwhile, you have the Benji stuff going on. So platforms being raised. Meanwhile, you have Rebecca Isla, who's there with putting together her gun. And then you have Lane watching the opera, seeing things unfold through his henchman's eyes. And then you have the prime minister in his box seat, all to Pacini, which McQuarrie purposely picked because he felt there were certain key notes, like when Tom Cruise jumps from the scaffolding onto the henchman. Like, he's like, yeah, he goes, I wanted that beat. I wanted that note to go down. And I listened to this and I'm like going, that's just fantastic to me. It was the longest sequence to film and to put together. But, like, you know, and they had to build that set from bottom up. And it, to me, I just thought it played great. Because as an audience member, I loved the, well, here she is putting the gun together. Oh, but there's Ethan Hunt going up the stairs. Mm. I love that stuff. I love that scene. I get what you're saying, all for naught. But I think Ethan Hunt learned so much more from that that I think that it helped perpetuate more of our story.
It learned how an assassin in wearing a dress would shoot and kick her legs and what the hell?
Didn't bother me at all.
Like, oh, come on, really?
I love that.
She couldn't think of a better way to show her leg off. I mean, that looked ridiculous.
From just a work of art, that was a beautiful frame of film.
It is, but
it's a beautiful leg.
It's a beautiful leg, but it's ridiculous in terms of, oh, I'm going to put my leg here to brace myself. It was stupid. It looks great, but it was stupid.
That was the last thing that I was thinking about.
You couldn't think of a better way to do that? Yeah. Lazy.
With your wife? Is that why you think you already had these excuses pre-planned?
No. I mean, seriously. I mean, fine. Show off the nice leg, but just come up and go the better way to do it. It's just stupid.
And that scene, too, it, to me, anyways, it reminded me of the awesome set piece scene in Skyfall, where Bond is hunting down an assassin, and he's in this building, this glass building, and it's being reflective of all this stuff going on, like these lights, and somebody picks up a gun like that and was like, wow, this is great. And McQuarrie's direction too, the way that he selected his scenes and shots, like, you know, there's also an amazing close-up of Rebecca Ferguson as Isla. She comes up to like some decorative paneling, and there's a great scene of her like just looking out in the way that she's lit. Again, cinematography and the way that this movie looked to me, even with that leg, I just thought it was great. And then the water sequence too looked amazing as well. And it kept, for me, it kept suspense. And you saw one of those things go this way. I didn't see it go the other way until, oh my God, he got taken out. Wait, what the hell? That's a great scene. But yeah, that's good stuff.
You didn't see that thing coming back to get him?
You knew that it was going to, it was in a trailer.
Right.
You know,
oh, really?
But
okay.
Again, it's, to me, it's the way you choreograph and you set up action. Mm-hmm. And it's the way how, like, you just set up your hurdles for your character. Other than just, look, holding your breath for 2 to 3 minutes is enough. Having to jump down in a thing in a suit that has no metal and you have to jump straight down the middle, that's one thing, you know, and then he's swimming around. But then to have these revolving, like, things going around, that just,
That sequence isn't. It was okay. It didn't really do anything for me. But
really,
it's okay. But I thought I was waiting for is, okay, so he's got the two ID cards or whatever it is.
Right.
And they get mixed up and he has to put one in. I never got that there was a, you know, you could tell which one was which. So I was going, oh, obviously, which one do I put in? Oh, no. I only have this one. I have to put it in.
Yeah.
But then I was waiting for the moment after it was all done when he lets Benji know what he did. Then it was a 50-50 chance.
Right.
But no, we didn't get this. Like, what? You didn't tell Benji that? That would have been a great thing for Benji to hear.
I think he was a little out of breath.
Yeah, I know. But at some point, I wanted that happen because I wanted to see Benji realize, you did what?
What happened?
Well, exactly.
He did die.
Yeah.
So, you know, on the scale of losing a card and you know, taking a chance to dying, I think, you know, when Benji goes, Ethan, you were just dead 2 minutes ago. And he's like, was what?
Yeah, exactly. No, that part was great, too. I was just going, I just wanted to see it. It was going to happen, but it didn't get happen.
Yeah.
So I get disappointed a lot.
Sorry.
Yeah.
You gotta have lower expectations.
I do. But well, this I like these movies. These are great movies. They usually
they're fun.
Are. They are, and this one was fun by any, by all means. It was fun. It was just that those moments I miss.
It's one of my favorites. You know, and again, the water sequence, the car chase is great too. And you know, you think about, for me, I had to think. I'm thinking like Tom Cruise really is a star. He's been around like forever. Okay, and when you think about the people that he's actually crossed paths with and intermingled with and how that has led to certain aspects of his life, like, for example, car chase scenes, right? Mm-hmm. Him driving a car and or riding a motorcycle.
Days of Thunder.
Yeah. He also meets Paul Newman in his life. And Paul Newman, like, hey, come on, I'm going to teach you how to drive stock car. You know, they became good friends. And he learned how to actually do stunt driving, like doing that. Mm-hmm. I forget what they call the term, but it's when you lift up the brake and you do a spin. So
E-brake turn? I don't know.
Something like that. And he knows how to do this stuff. And that, to me, it really, when you think about it, it really does add that.
By the way, if you do want winning the Paul Newman documentary has a lot of Tom Cruise and Paul Newman footage.
Yeah.
It's really, actually really great, so check out that documentary. It's available on VOD.
That's great. I will. So, you know, and you go, wow, because of this, Tom Cruise, through his later on in life, has been able to parlay this stuff. And then he really does take his filming seriously.
Mm-hmm. He does. And by the way, I get there's like the Scientology side of Tom Cruise, and everyone always goes to that. And, you know, then there's the Katie Holmes side and whatever. But this guy, I've never heard anyone say a mean thing about him.
No.
Ever. And I don't think that's a coincidence. I don't, you know, there's some people who can act nice and whatever, but I think he, you know, he is that type of genuine nice person.
Yeah, outside of maybe some of the women in his life, but you're right. The Scientology thing aside, so long as, I mean, I've never seen him hurt anybody with the Scientology, and I don't know what's going on behind closed doors between whatever. I don't follow that stuff. I don't care about that stuff. I don't care about him jumping up and down on a couch telling the world how much he loves Katie Holmes. I don't, like, who cares? Like, why is that so, like, what makes it that cuckoo? Because we've seen other comedians do cuckoo stuff on TV, but that never bothered me. But his stardom really, you know, when you think about his dedication to the craft, and again, just going to Rogue Nation, with him saying, I'm not going to wear a helmet while doing this motorcycle. Now, could there have been, like, maybe they sped up a frame or two? I don't know. But there is a scene when he was leaning down, so far down, and he's not wearing the knee pads, that he actually is, like, moving his knee, like, because he knows how far down he is, and he's not wearing any pads at all. That made the sequence that much more exciting for me, because I'm only going, oh my God, he's going to lose a leg or something. It's like the element of danger is.
Maybe the insurance on him is.
Well, let's speak to insurance, Dimitri, since you happen to have some.
Because he actually. Well, I don't have numbers.
Especially about the airplane. I believe it was the airplane stunt, if I'm not mistaken, that caused this, right?
They don't specifically. They talk about the airplane stunt and him driving, but believe it or not, he fired the insurance company on this movie.
He was one of the producers.
Yeah, you know, and basically, you know, you have your stars, you have these huge film productions and budgets that's hinged on the star, so a lot of insurance is taken out on them. Tom Cruise enjoys doing his own stunts, as we learned from Mission Impossible 3 special features. Really great stuff. So when, you know, you can't really combine the two, and sometimes a star will get away with doing a fight scene or something. Mm-hmm. Like The Rock says he's proud of doing a lot of his own stunts. But you got Tom Cruise, and when you have a stunt that is too dangerous and the insurance company says,
we won't
insure
the film.
Yep, nope, we're not going to insure it. We're not going to allow him to do that. And then Tom Cruise basically says he fires him. He's like, oh, well, if you're not going to allow me to do that,
we're gonna get somebody else.
And now it's somebody else. And to me, that's like, again, it's the power of Tom Cruise. And he says, look, I can do this. He's confident about himself. And his whole thing is like, listen, whether I'm hanging on a building in Dubai or whether I'm on an airplane, if something goes wrong, dead is dead. I'm dead regardless. It's going to be, so I want to be the guy that's up there. Now, again, that's really not thinking too much about the rest of the people who need jobs for like the next 8 months. But still, I respect that he's willing to do that. Look, I'm not that kind of a thrill seeker. So if I can live vicariously through him, I'd rather. And, you know, but I look at that motorcycle. He won't wear a helmet specifically. He thinks the audience needs to see that
it's him.
It could be egotistical, okay. But at the same time, it's an old school kind of filmmaking that he even references back to the days of Buster Keaton and Harold Lloyd and Charlie Chaplin, where, you know, Harold Lloyd is actually hanging off of a clock tower and Buster Keaton was on a train falling from, like, these silent film stars were putting themselves in jeopardy for their art. And to either convey comedy, to convey suspense and thrills. And he's like, that's the way it was done. That's the way I want to do it. And it's for me, anyways, a film fan, that's a great carry through to me.
Not for the insurance company. Because I can say, I mean, the last thing you want to be is the insurance company that let this guy do this.
Yeah. And then something went wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, but. Whatever. I'm sure they just had to pay higher premiums.
Well, you know, but we always, and we do hear stunts go awry.
Sure.
You know, there's a horrible tragic case that's continuing that took place on a trestle bridge, yeah. You know, and stuff. So there, yes, we know that stunts can go awry. And, you know, I just actually appreciate that Tom Cruise, you know, he puts himself out there for it. Yeah, he was hanging on a freaking cliff in Mission Impossible 2.
Well, and he's hanging off a plane.
Yeah,
so he's 52. He's 53. Whatever. I don't know how old he is, and he's doing that. So, and he still looks good doing it. So, and people still want to see him do it.
Yeah.
Just it's sure you can do anything.
And son of a bitch, he still does look good. You know, he gets away with it.
I thought the favorite trick he did was escaping the interrogation sequence when he was shackled to the pole.
Yeah, where he goes above the pole.
Inverts himself and kicks up. And I say, nice. You know, being a gymnast, I'm going, I know what that takes. That ain't easy.
Yeah.
So
that was a great
brilliant
sequence.
Thank God it was in a pole all the way into the ceiling.
Yeah, no, thank God.
Because that would have been a short trip.
Oh, shit.
Oops.
What was your, was that your favorite sequence? That opening,
You know, I like that fight sequence a lot. The one thing I didn't like is that they left out a couple of wide shots, so the context was really sort of narrow. You didn't get to see everything. I didn't think you did.
Here's what maybe I agree with you, but in general, as an action movie, we stayed overall wide.
We did,
because I don't know. Maybe we're, and I've said this for a couple of movies at this point this year, so maybe it's just upswing into that sort of action style. But
when we did the action sequence, like that one, they went really tight, and I'm going, sometimes it was too tight, and you didn't really get to see where the players were and stuff like that. Even in the chase sequence with the cars, I'm going, because you know you were really in those tight alleys, but we never really got to see. Like
there's worse movies. There's movies that like all you see is like a pinky.
Yeah,
and he's like,
true.
What am I watching?
Yeah,
what am I watching? Come on,
you're absolutely right.
But I'll take it a step further, though. I think deliberately, especially in the car chase.
I mean, this is no Les Mis. That's pretty.
No. But I think like the car chase sequence, because we're in such a tight alley too. I think that your frame of focus, limiting it, also great, brought up to some great surprises in how he took bad guys out, whether it's by spinning the car.
That was great. I love that. I just wanted a wide shot every once in a while to give me context so I could see that and really enjoy that, because it happened in a way that was like, oh, I only get to see part of it, not the whole thing.
To me, I caught the claustrophobicness of having to drive a car. And again,
no, that part was great. I love that, the especially the turns and just missing the walls.
That was awesome.
Fabulous. I'm not saying change that. I'm saying every once in a while, add a contact shot so we can see how that happened.
The geography of it. Like,
that would have been nice.
Yeah.
So, you know, just anyway.
Fair enough.
We got to move on.
Do you have your seatbelt on?
Yeah.
And that scene, too, like flipping the car.
Yeah.
Because, in a B action or a very, you know, testosterone filled action movie. That car would have like flown off the steps and just landed, and then they would have like this car. It was totaled.
Yeah, it was nice.
The insurance company.
I even liked the shot, the sliding, the car sliding, it rallying in. I mean, it was great. Yeah, that was terrific. So a lot of great action sequences. Anyway, let's move on to other things. We've talked about cinematography. What else do we want to talk about? We talked about acting a little bit. What, we didn't say anything about Jeremy or Alec in terms of their acting. Did you like seeing Alec Baldwin on the screen? His gravitas as always.
I thought he did good.
Yeah,
I think and it made sense. For me, not much more I can add to it.
Yeah, I mean, again, it seems that his character now is going to be part of the team.
You think he'll be there? Well, he's the secretary now. He's part of MI.
You know, and that's another interesting thing too, because we've had like Lawrence Fishburne was in Part 3.
Right. Yeah.
He was the head of the team. There was that I forget the actor in Mission Impossible. The first one who was who was dogging Ethan Hunt. So we've always had different heads.
Because they come and go.
But I think bringing Alec Baldwin onto the team is sort of kind of like bringing Kurt Russell into Fast and Furious, in a sense, because not that Alec Baldwin's going to do that kind of action, but I think he lends with his character, with his acting. There can be some humor involved, and the way that he and Jeremy Renner,
their give and take was one. Yeah, it was fun.
I thought that was a lot of fun, and obviously it seems Jeremy Renner is really happy to be where he is.
Yeah, thanks. You do all the running. I'll kind of not sit back.
Yeah, yeah, and I don't know. Maybe it was just me. I liked the stuff. And again, you know, just going back to your earlier statement, you know, Jeremy Renner was always there going, Ethan, I cannot protect you. Like, you've got to come in right now. And I actually was wondering about the loyalties of that character, which I thought was brilliant, because even the way he was brought in Ghost Protocol,
You're iffy about him.
A little iffy. And then at the end, okay.
And they show him, he's making the phone call in London and stuff, and then, you know, you don't know it's a wink and a nod right then. So I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah. So to me, that was clever, and I thought he played it well. And to me, it did say that, you know what, the CIA is on your case, and there's nothing I can do. Mm-hmm. I can't save you. And you know what? I need to bring you in. Like, come, you know, and there was even from Ving Rhames, like, who said, if I even doubt for a second about your validity, I'm going to take you down. You know, so I really liked, to me, that character alone. I didn't need CIA special ops coming into fire.
I didn't need him either. I'm just saying, if you don't need him, don't bring it up.
Yeah.
Because I was waiting for it. Yeah. Please, yeah, bring it on. I would want to see everybody against him. Because that's kind of, I was like, yeah, that's like the Bourne Identity. He's got assassins after him. That's cool.
But I look at Mission Impossible a little bit different from Bourne.
I'm not saying make the same movie. I'm just saying you can make that work. Yeah. And if you're going to set it up, then make it work, or don't set it up.
Interesting.
That's my thought.
Fair enough.
Because it would have been fine without it. You still had a great action movie. You just don't. For me, it's like you set it up and like, oh, good, we're going to get to see everybody come after him. Okay. Oh,
and
we didn't
happen for you. Okay,
so that's all.
All right.
Because I don't think they needed it at all. But if they were going to. If they did it, it would have been cool too.
I want to add something too, because to me, I was thinking about this while watching this. Mission Impossible, especially this one, somewhat gadgetry. You know,
yeah, but
gadgety,
it
right?
Always is, yeah.
Right. But to me, it's interesting because James Bond, on the other hand, has taken, like, they've sort of kind of.
There's been an evolution in their gadgetry. It used to be all, you know.
But literally, especially with the most recent ones, beginning with Casino Royale, the gadgetry has not, you know, it's sort
they've
of taken
down.
A seat, which is great.
Part of it's, I agree that that's the trend of James Bond, but also you have to, I mean, how many movies is this? 45 at this point versus 5?
Yeah, exactly. No, I get it.
So... you got to mix things up when you got 45.
No, I get it, but the dependency on gadgetry in the James Bond movies is sort of kind of tempered down on purpose, which is cool, which in this movie, I sort of kind of like that we have a little bit of gadgetry.
I love their keys.
Yeah, the keys are awesome. Amazing. Yeah, that was great.
But really?
Yeah, I like that. And in not only the keys, but he had a ring that would go around.
I
think it was great too.
Okay.
So I appreciated, because I guess we're getting a little bit less and less in James Bond, don't get me wrong, I don't think that's a bad thing, but it's nice to see it utilized in a Mission Impossible movie. And they don't do it gratuitously, I don't think. It didn't bother me. It just made sense to me. I think gratuitously is what was happening with Bond.
I get one of those keys, though.
Oh, that's... It's over.
That was cool.
It's over. So, but I thought Renner was great. I liked Alec Baldwin. To me, the standout, you know, Simon Pegg is great comedic relief. Yeah,
everybody did a really good job. I just don't think they're giving it for the villain to do.
Yeah, and I liked him. I really liked him a lot.
He was okay to serve as a Bobby, just didn't he?
I think it was the fact of eventually it was split between Lane and the henchman, right, Mr. Bones.
Right, yeah.
And so eventually, you know, I felt like you should have gotten rid of Mr. Bones, so the focus could have been fully on Lane. Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
You know, but to me, the standout, like, I liked Sean Harris as Solomon Lane, but I really liked Rebecca Ferguson as Isla Frost. There was something about her, not only could she carry a gun.
It was Faust.
I enjoyed that she could carry a fight scene, look good, like, she could handle a gun, and she sold it on screen. But then again, when she's being duped, there was her vulnerability as well. And she was playing off of anger after, like, my own country is screwing me over. Like, what am I going to do? And I especially enjoyed at the end, you know, her words with Ethan Hunt. Like, you know, I like that. And they make it appear that she's going to be in one way, shape, or form
team. I think she earned it. I thought she did. You know, she was the biggest surprise of the movie because everybody else you've seen. But for me, she was the biggest and held her own and everything and did a fabulous job.
Part of it, you know, you can't help but question her loyalty because you know that she's a double agent. Yeah. Well, now she's a triple agent. And at what point does
layer upon layer?
I mean, anytime you get these types of movies, that's a question.
Yeah.
And so you can't trust anything.
You know, but with her, I do believe that she was doing it for the good of the queen. I mean, I really think that
I think she was doing it for the country, sure.
Yeah, well, I think she was doing it for the country.
Fine, but again, by the end, you can make that ultimate conclusion. But as you're watching it...
No, that's true. I mean, all along I'm going... they put just enough hint, just enough doubt in there where I was going, okay, no, I think she, no, well, yeah. You know. So that was good. Shifting alliances.
Jeremy Renner's character, too. Yeah.
So that part was wonderfully subtle.
Yeah.
Nuanced.
Very well done. And again, I think that's direction and acting, and maybe even, you know, to a degree too with editing
and the writing too.
Yeah,
because I mean, you have to have that in there to play that shade.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and then, you know, we can talk about Solomon Lane, who's played by Sean Harris, who you know, I thought as a villain, I thought he was very good. He was steely, cold.
I think he has a good look.
Yeah, he has a really good
look. I don't know what it says about him, but I thought he had a good look.
Yeah, and ironically, he didn't even want to be in the movie.
He didn't
want to be in the movie.
Why not?
That's where the cold look comes from.
You know, to me, this is,
a lot of actors don't want to play villains, and I find that weird.
It's like, yeah, I mean, you get to really... chew up the scenery if you want.
Well, he's like... because McQuarrie had wanted him in the movie, and his knee-jerk reaction was no.
No,
I don't want to be in that. He goes, I don't want to be in five of these things. I don't want to be in a franchise. Now, I'm of the type... Wow. Like,
everybody else is dying to get in.
I enjoy work, and it's great that he can... And this isn't a judgment on him. This is my own personal thing. It's like, wow, I can get five movies out of this?
Yeah, well,
he's saying,
I want to have a varied palette.
I get it, but what else are you doing? Yeah. What's keeping you so busy? Like, you can't do one of these movies every other. But okay, fine. So then he convinces him to come into this movie. And one of the things that he said, you know, you got to promise me. He goes, you're going to promise me you're going to kill me at the end of this movie. He must promise me, he goes, because, you know, please don't bring me back because I don't want to be in five of these movies.
Oh, you just say no. Well, how's that?
Well,
and then he doesn't kill him off.
Sean, I've got bad news for you. It's really not up to you. And it isn't up to me. If the audience likes you, you know, I'll kill you. I can kill you right now. He goes, see this pen in my hand? I'll just kill you. He goes, but you know, when the next movie comes along, you have a diabolical twin brother or a clone. He goes, it's the movie. You're coming back whether you like it or not. And then he even made, they filmed the scene too. There's some mystery about this.
The kill scene?
They filmed, nothing is said other than a scene was filmed with Sean Harris and Solomon Lane, and it was the scene too that on paper, it convinced John Harris to do the movie. He loved the scene so much. And they filmed said scene, and then they cut it. It's not in the movie. And McQuarrie said, we cut it out. I want you to see the whole movie. And in the end, when Sean Harris saw the movie from the complete movie, he was like very happy with the way that it played out. Hell, they didn't even have an ending.
Yeah, I know they had to redo that.
Yeah, it's not even that they
stopped shooting.
They were working on an ending because Paramount wanted something bigger.
Yeah.
They wanted it to end with the plane sequence.
Sure.
And
of course.
Ronnie just tacked that on then.
Yeah. So, and they wanted something bigger, and Cruise and McQuarrie didn't feel they could have gone that way, and they could have ended big.
They fought for this.
Yeah, and McQuarrie really fought.
Interesting. I wonder why.
More
personal.
Yeah, and to me, it worked.
Did it work for you?
I thought this. Here's the thing. I prefer movies because, you know, however it structures, at the end of the day, you want to have that connection, or you want, like, a wow factor. And yes, you could throw in, you know, and that's why, like, Transformers. Yes, it makes a lot of movies, but at least in America, the audience is like, oh, it's just too much spectacle and not enough oomph. Mm-hmm. This, the fact that it doesn't have to have the grandest of all action sequences and still have a wow ending is brilliant. It just goes to show that they've told, you know, a complex story really well. They've done the two. And just to go to action just because you need action, again, it's an easy out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
not for this movie. They've done everything so well up until the last point.
Yeah,
so it worked for you as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
To me, it harkened back to World War Z. Mm-hmm. Okay, if you think about the structure of that movie, and that movie had a lot of overproduction, a lot of film, but that movie starts off big as well. And by the time we're through with that journey, it becomes a very intimate. It's that one Brad Pitt character trying to get this antidote in this hospital, and it's very claustrophobic. So, you know, and you appreciate the emotional punch that has. Just like in this movie, at the end, when those walls come up, and it's just our good guys and our villain trapped, and he's being gassed, like the poetic justice that happens, and Ethan Hunt is like, yeah, I got you, buddy. Like, that is better than any huge explosion that you can have. And McQuarrie was great. He really was under a great deal of pressure to end the movie with a huge, you know, stunt and have it be the biggest, you know, part of the movie.
Right.
And
because that's how they usually go.
That's how it goes. And McQuarrie's like, why? He's like, what do you care? It's going to be in that would be in the trailer. Why do you care? He's like, because I'm going to film it. Part of it's going to be in the trailer. He goes, no. He goes, like, and I'm glad that I'm glad that better heads prevailed, because I really do think that it sets up a good, nice personal tone for Ethan Hunt too, for that character, because he, in the end, realizes, you know, I am still good at this game, and I'm not crazy. Like, here's your bad guy. You know, here's your bad guy, CIA. And here's my team to show that we can do this. And we left a little bit of bedlam and chaos behind us, but there was a really good reason for that.
Mm-hmm. And then they could safely say, at least at the end, we didn't blow anything up.
Yeah, we didn't.
Unlike the Kremlin.
Right.
All right.
So, but this one scene, I think, is a mystery scene. Whether it shows up on a Blu-ray.
God, I want to see it now.
And me too. And every single, in my research,
that might have been
I wanted to
the
know
thing
what
that
scene
I was missing.
Was. It could be, that's funny. It could be it.
Yeah.
But he doesn't talk about it. So I wonder if they'll put it onto the Blu-ray. I don't know. but mm-hmm. there is a scene out there floating or in an editing room or in mm-hmm. a can somewhere or in a hard drive that we have yet to see. And it is the scene that sold Sean Harrison to doing the movie. It better be a good scene.
Yeah. Can you imagine me see it and go, really? That was it? Yeah. That convinced him?
Yeah.
So, because I've seen worse.
Maybe.
All right. What else do we want to talk about? Music. We obviously.
I mean, music, you got the variations of the theme.
Right.
And that's every time that hits, they used it a lot, but they used it also, ironically, still strategically.
Yeah, I thought so. Yeah. You know, and it's amazing when it kicks in. I remember seeing the TV show, but the repeats and all that other stuff. You've never seen it.
Yeah.
Phil, and I remember loving it as a kid. I mean, we played Mission Impossible when we were kids.
Yeah, and how awesome! And this to me sort of kind of because I don't recall the opening music. Sequences. Well, the music, but it was always done to the Litwick,
right.
like going through.
Yeah.
But what was great, and when you think about this for television, mm-hmm. okay, forget about a movie because you sort of have a little bit more time. But in television, in the television show, you're following this Litwick go, and as it's going, you're actually seeing scenes of the episode that you're about to watch, much like in this movie, much like in the first Mission Impossible movie, you're seeing scenes from the thing. But on television, like you needed to film that, and like, we gotta
put it into
the opening credit sequence, you know. And again, I thought it was very well done, very very well used, built suspense. It was great. It was there when it was needed, and not there when it wasn't. His use of Puccini, which is music as well, I thought was great for the Vienna Opera House and how he set it up and his reason for using it after learning about it. It made it, wow, that's really cool. He actually did pay attention to the notes that were written on the page, and he wanted to punctuate this scene, and I thought it was great. Great, 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 great stuff.
Well, let's talk about its reception.
Mission Impossible.
There you go. And who would think that the fifth one out of the gate would be the number one?
I mean, you build over time type of thing.
Really? Because, four did pretty well.
But, I mean, look at Fast and the Furious.
Yeah, that's true.
So, I mean, there's examples of both ways. Mm-hmm. You know, a franchise can get stale, franchise can go up. I think this is a great example. And for Tom Cruise, Mission Impossible has been his strongest to date.
Yeah, was it his biggest opening, or did he hear War of the Worlds was bigger? I can't remember.
That's a good question. I mean, he continues to do these. I can find that. I wanted to talk a little. You know, you bring up Fast and the Furious, and there is sort of kind of a parallel when you think about it, although they differ in a couple of different ways. Fast and Furious, the second, third one, and what was it? When was it that Justin Lin took over? Was it the fourth? Okay. The second and third ones sort of kind of declined, like Tokyo Drift, and then they had to retool. With Tom Cruise and Mission Impossible, it wasn't necessarily retooling your franchise. It was retooling your actor. Because if you remember with Mission Impossible 3... and even going into War of the Worlds, I forget which one came out first, but he had all this jumping on the couch, this going, people thinking him as being a loon, and which really hurt him. So doing Mission Impossible 3, I think, with Cruise, and then you bring in J.J. Abrams, was in a sense trying to bring him back, back up to stature, in a sense. And I think people were looking at Mission Impossible 3 wanting to dislike it, but Abrams and Cruise and company put together a solid action movie that was really good, that you really couldn't ignore, and you couldn't say that movie stunk, in which he was able to build and then do Ghost Protocol, which really built from some great sequences in 3, and then they outdo themselves in Ghost Protocol in a way. And they, yet again, you get Brad Bird, who's making his live-action debut, going, how's this guy going to fit into this? How's he going to do? And, I think it's genius, and you set up, yet again, some other great sequences with Tom Cruise. And then, he's been doing some other movies. I think Tropic Thunder really helped Cruise's career as well.
That helped a lot. Well, not that most of them didn't quite need it, but
no.
Yeah.
That was a brilliant movie.
So, I mean, is it safe to say that, that he's back? I say he never really left.
Yeah,
I mean, but people
Edge of Tomorrow did great.
not box office wise.
Well,
but
commercially, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but it's
not commercial. I'm sorry, but everybody thought he did a great job, and it was a good movie.
It's a good movie. It's. Yeah. I'd say it's the most underappreciated summer blockbuster of last year. Yeah. I mean, more people should have gone to that movie. But as the case in this town, they're really they can't wait to start putting nails in a coffin.
Yeah.
And but yet he again, and this is what I think makes him a star. Look. He's, I don't want to call him Teflon, but he really weathers, he weathers the storm.
And he's had a lot, he's had a lot to weather. But, and smart that they had it now rather than to compete in December.
Right.
Because they had, well, and let's face it, this is what the best, where are we in the summer in terms of its rating? It's not as good
as far as Rotten Tomatoes goes?
No, Jurassic. I mean, what, for an opening weekend.
Well, this did $55 million.
Yeah, 55.
Opening weekend. It was number one. Mm-hmm. So its domestic total is probably at this point somewhere around 80. It's domestic.
Domestic big
part. Its domestic total is somewhere around 80. Its worldwide total, I would say, is closer to 145, 150 at this point. You know, I'm trying to estimate for Friday numbers. 150 worldwide in its first week of play. Yeah, Tom Cruise internationally. Really, you know, really helped. Now, the other thing, too, that we didn't mention that I found very... like, I think this movie has a cavalcade of stories. The other one being, this is the first feature film that is fully Chinese Alibaba funded. I mean, Alibaba gets a logo at the beginning of
that
this movie.
That was freaky. I was not expecting that.
Yeah. And, you know, the what is going on with there... you know, with the synergy between, like, what Alibaba brought to the table outside of money. Mm-hmm. You know, Alibaba was sort of kind of smart. Did you know that Alibaba owns a ticketing service in China? They own one of the biggest apps in order to sell movie tickets.
To be honest, I'd never heard of Alibaba before this.
Oh, really?
Except the other Alibaba.
They're huge.
Well, there has been, within these past few years... China seeping into our Hollywood movie industry.
Yeah. Well, someone's, I mean, they have a stake in AMC.
In other ways, just in piracy.
In AMC, I believe, in some part with like some studios. At the same time, the last Transformers movie was partially China funded, and they got to film there. But this Alibaba group, which is, you know, they've been kicking the tires in Hollywood, whether they're going to buy like a smaller studio. They've been wanting to make a big play. And this is their Mission Impossible Rogue Nation is the first fully funded from Alibaba and the Chinese. Now, they have a group called Taobao Movie. And they have an online ticketing and advanced seat selection app in China. Okay. So, and on top of that, this Alibaba, that is tied into mobile shopping app. So people can get Mission Impossible 5 merchandise or any other kind of merchandise that they may want via this Alibaba and this Taobao movies, which to me is it's very fascinating, and I'm wondering where this is all going to go for the future moviegoer. You go see a movie, you come out, and the app in which you bought your ticket from is going to say, "You've seen the movie. Wear the hat. You know, wear the jacket. You know, buy
listen
a shirt.
To Anatomy.
Yeah, listen to Anatomy of a Movie. You know, or go buy some milk. You know, who knows? But it's the start of something." I don't know exactly what yet, but a seed has been planted with this movie, and if these grosses continue, you know, I think
so. Those are the grosses. Critics are saying he's back, even though he never left.
He never left.
Saying that he did a really good job. Everybody's liking. They're really touting Rebecca because she did such a good job.
93% on Rotten Tomatoes, right.
And what is it? 75 out of 100 on Metacritic. We got an A minus on CinemaScore.
A minus on CinemaScore, which is really solid for this. You know, you know, the reception is you know, I think it's going to have.
And they're already doing MI6.
Yep, he's already said I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
So I just wonder who's going to be back, and I think Christopher McQuarrie is going to.
Oh, is that right?
I believe he's going to come back.
I know they ain't that yet.
You know, as well. So, and I know that there's another Jack Reacher. Tom Cruise has said, I guess there's going to be, he wants an Edge of Tomorrow too. And he wants Christopher McQuarrie to not only write it, but direct that as well.
Can Edge of Tomorrow too be, okay.
Sure, why not?
Okay.
I mean, I'm with you. I mean, I don't know how you go.
That'd be like Inception 2.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah,
Inceptioner?
More ink stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It would be interesting. Yeah. But listen, I was impressed with what McQuarrie gave us. Whether or not he was working off of pre-existing material, mm-hmm. I really believe that for an action movie of this type, you know, based on what the television show was, mm-hmm. he really set up, for me anyways, he set up great twists and turns that kept me excited. I had I was grinning ear to ear. The action sequences, I honestly didn't know at some points, like, where certain characters were going to go. Mm-hmm. That, to me, for a summer action movie, is sort of kind of refreshing. So... we'll see what McQuarrie and company have to offer.
Well, that sounded like your last word, Dimitri. I think I'm going to take my cue to that last word.
I really loved it. I'm glad it was able to stand alone. I'm sure it had plenty of Easter eggs, as you guys already mentioned. An all-around great movie. Just honestly, really, really good movie. Refreshing in terms of its action. I know you mentioned best since Mad Max. I personally hated Mad Max, so to me, this was
Fury Road. You hated that, huh? Wow!
Don't get me started.
So this
on
was
that.
Your best action movie for the season. I'm glad you finally got to see one.
Yeah,
me too. You should see the others. There are some really good movies.
I think so. You might find two a little dated. Like, it doesn't. Yeah. But three and
two works.
And
Four
Ghost
works.
Protocol.
Yeah. Yeah, I see them. I don't.
One, you just get the foundation with one. So, yeah.
But it's great. Some great Brian De Palma.
Sure.
Visionary and cinematography.
I'm just amazed at the fact that the very few TV shows have gone from TV shows to big screen, and we've kind of talked about that on other episodes. And so the fact that, you know, not only was it successful once, but to build a franchise on top of a successful TV show. Yeah.
But did we talk about? Did we talk? No, we didn't talk about. Like, it's like the television show owes all of its credit, mm-hmm. along with another very popular television show to Lucille Ball.
Hetty Desilu,
and had it not been for Lucille Ball,
we would never have had
Star Trek. Or Mission Impossible. She, you know, as head of Desilu Productions, she really enjoyed, as a television choice.
She championed them.
And she said yes to both of them, and they produced them. Mm-hmm. And probably the two most successful things that came out of Desilu.
But they were huge.
But they were huge for television. And it took longer for Mission Impossible to make it to the big screen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it had a longer TV run.
It did. It had a longer TV run than Star Trek did.
Yeah. But a longer time
to get on to...
which
to
is a surprise screen. Because it lends itself so much to film.
Absolutely.
It's always a caper. There's always, you know, spies. I mean, it's the whole thing.
Yeah, and you can make them one-offs.
Yeah.
Lucille Ball, comedian, vaudeville, movies, television.
Yeah.
And, you know, thanks to her, we get Mission
so
Impossible.
So Ethan Hunt is all due to her.
Yep.
She better give him some royalties.
I think her kids might be.
All right, that's it. We got to get out of here. So, Dimitri, where can they find you?
You can find me at DMovies 1701. And actually, folks, this is my last Anatomy of a Movie. For about 3 weeks.
That's right. Dimitri's going to take a long overdue vacation.
In London and in Greece.
Mm-hmm. He'll be filming in London and in Greece.
Do you hear that, folks? That is the thunderous applause of our audience going, thank God!
I highly doubt it.
I hope.
You can follow us here at The Popcorn Talk and Movie Anatomy specifically. And don't forget to check out all the wonderful other shows.
Box Office Breakdown.
That's right. You want to know how this movie pairs up this week against Fantastic Four? Check out Box Office Breakdown.
DC Comic News.
DC Movie News. Marvel Movie News. Jedi Alliance. Cosplay Coach. Do... Games Make Good Movies, and Schmoes Knows, and so many others. I'm sure I'm missing like five.
Yeah, I know. There's a bunch of them. So please check them all out.
That's why we're the Popcorn Talk Network. Maybe somebody will make a movie of one of our things.
Mm-hmm. There it is. And that's it. And you can find us here next time. We'll talk to you. Thanks again.
Bye, guys. Bye.
Views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.